It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, we'll look at the Pope's recent comments on family planning and contraception.
First, if you've ever stopped into your local grocery store to pick up some beer, you've probably noticed there's no shortage of brands to choose from. But in terms of how that beer is sold, well, there's pretty much cans or bottles for you.
Well, that could soon be changing in Wisconsin. The state's Grocers Association is lobbying for the right to offer growler refills in stores. It's basically a jug of fresh beer right out of the tap, and legislation could soon be coming that would allow for just that. That might be good news for beer lovers, but not everyone is on board with that idea.
Here with us now to discuss what's going on is Robin Shepherd. He's a regional beer writer and beer correspondent for Isthmus Newspaper in Madison. Robin, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk the technology first. Can you explain what a growler is?
Certainly. A growler is basically a glass jug or a jar. It's customarily what we see a lot of in Wisconsin are the 64-ounce varieties, you know, just a little short of 2 liters. As you travel around, there are smaller half growler versions. Some states also allow even up to a gallon in size. But generally, they are takeout beer in a 64-ounce container that you can buy fresh beer. Fresh draft beer. And you find them in breweries and brew pubs primarily. That's really where all of this started, is that when particularly the brew pub trade is where you see it a lot. So if you want to take something after you've had a nice meal and you want to take a little something more home with you, you can get your favorite from the taps right there, fresh that night, take it home. There's some pros and cons we can talk about in terms of the growlers, but generally it's a way to bring fresh draft beer home.
Yeah, so let's talk pros and cons for beer fans. You are one. You know many others. What is the appeal of getting this in a growler?
Well, a growler, I think, appeals to those folks who like that image of fresh draft beer, you know, with a nice bright carbonation level. It's right out of the small keg, and you can take it home right there. Now, what we're seeing in the debate whether or not grocery stores will be buying or will be selling growlers is that we're seeing grocery stores express some interest in sort of offering some rare, hard-to-find ones. So it wouldn't be that necessarily what you would find would be the same ones that if you look in the cooler, for example. This is a way to really appeal to the beer aficionados, the craft beer enthusiast, of saying, well, we might offer this draft, this growler, fresh growler of this beer from California or this beer from Maryland. I think it's a way to take it home in a size too that's is actually not bad for a meal of 2 to 3 people. When you think about it, it's slightly less than a 6-pack. So it's convenient. It's fresh. The drawback side of it is that growlers aren't they're not really known for aging beers very well. It's really the side of it is fresh beer. Once you open a growler, the thinking by almost all conventional beer enthusiasts is you need to finish that growler because you can't really get the cap tight enough to sort of keep the carbonation level. Growlers aren't very good for aging, even really big malty high alcohol beers at all. They're meant to be drank when you get them. They're all about freshness.
So, as you said, these are mostly in breweries, brew pubs. Why are we seeing a push from now it's the Grocery Association to try to make it easier for grocery stores to be able to? So I guess the way this would work is I'd take my growler into the grocery store, go up to the tap or hand it to the worker at the tap. They fill it up. I come home with a fresh beer in my own growler.
Well, that would be the one way of thinking about it. Certainly, I think the majority of the places that are offering this service probably have their own growler there.
Oh.
So, for example, in Madison, the Fresh Madison Market has a growler filling station, and they have their own custom growler that says Madison Fresh Market right on the outside of the glass. So you would purchase that growler, or you might think of it as a deposit, because the thinking here is that repeat customers will bring back an empty growler to get it refilled. So that's really, you're right, that's the way it would work. You would go in, you might see a cart that has anywhere from 2 to 6 different kinds of beer on tap. You would say which one you want. They would fill it right there in the store. Then they would seal it with a plastic heat cap to mean that it's packaged there on site and it's not open when you leave the building. and you would take it home. And the thinking is that you have that growler as sort of a commemoration of that experience. You'd bring it back and have it filled right there on the spot again a few days later.
So right now, as you mentioned, there are a couple of grocery stores around the state that do this. But in effect, as I understand it, they have to get a tavern license. They have to be licensed like a bar would be. Is that right?
The way Wisconsin is looking at this is that Class A liquor license, if you think about those are basically the convenience store and what majority of grocery stores have when they sell packaged products of beer and wine. To do a growler fill, the way it's looked at on the state is that they would have to have a Class B liquor license, which are bars and taverns. You're filling something. So that's the debate. The Wisconsin Grocers Association is promoting a revisiting of what the Class A license is about to allow that fresh fill, seal, package right there on site, and you'll go out with it.
So you get that Class A license, but now it encompasses that growler refill.
That's correct. Now the stores, though, that are doing it now in the state, Madison has one, Milwaukee has a few stores that are already doing growler fill stations. It's my understanding that those grocery stores have already gotten a Class B license
like a tavern.
Right. There's another interesting model that's emerging in all of this, and they're basically growler filling stations, which are packaged stores where you would go in, and that's what they do. Doesn't really confuse it with the food at all, but you would go in, and it might be a liquor store, and you would just go in, and they would have the growler filling station, and they cater to people who love growlers.
Now, the Grocers Association, often prefixed with the powerful Grocers Association, is in favor of this. The Tavern League, often noted as the powerful Wisconsin Tavern League, is against it.
I think that's how you would probably draw the lines, is that those two would be on both sides of that. And in the middle, you have the Wisconsin Brewers Guild, maybe even the distributors, I think, to a certain degree. I'm not speaking for them, but I think those entities are kind of waiting to see how the bill gets shaped and what it looks like. It's my understanding the bill hasn't really surfaced yet. It's been promoted by the Wisconsin Grocers Association for probably over a year, maybe even longer. They've been talking about wanting to see these changes.
Okay, this could be a big lobbyist off there in the Capitol. One argument, and we hear this from people worried about things like drunk driving, a culture of alcohol in the state, is we already got a lot of options on places and ways to get alcohol in the state. Is this just like one more drip here, making it easier to get booze?
I think that's an argument that will be made in this. That has to be brought into the consideration. The public will be brought in, obviously, as we talk about changes in legislation, and that's a consideration that we need to explore in this state.
Well, one more thing I want to explore before we let you go, Robin. We were talking during the news. We don't know where the word growler, or I don't know where the word growler came from. What's up with that?
Well, there's some really fascinating historical kinds of yarns and legends about it. The one that I really enjoy is the growler emerged from the working class of Europe in the 1700s, and it was a container, basically an open pail. And what happened is that the workers, whether you were in the factories or the shipyards, you gave the kid a nickel, and they went down to the tavern where they filled the pail. Mm-hmm. And as the pail was slid across the bar, it made a growling sound.
Huh. Okay.
So that's the legend that I prefer. You can also sort of extrapolate that it took it, the beer was taken back to thirsty workers who had growling stomachs.
All right. We don't know which one is true.
Pick your own.
Pick which one we like to believe. All right. Well, Robin, thanks so much for being here and telling us what's going on.
My pleasure. It was fun.
That's Robin Shepherd. He's a regional beer writer and beer correspondent for Isthmus Magazine in Madison. Wisconsin's first modern streetcar may get a little push tomorrow from the Milwaukee Common Council, but conservatives are trying to stop the streetcar project from moving into high gear and say Milwaukee's better off staying with buses when it comes to mass transit. Chuck Kornbach reports.
One thing backers of the streetcar want to emphasize is that it is not something out of a Judy Garland movie. It's not an 1890s trolley. The streetcar would instead be a fully enclosed, short string of rail-like cars powered by overhead electric wires and glide on a rail built into the street, like this streetcar in Portland, Oregon. But it's taken some selling to get Milwaukee on board.
Hi, everyone. We're going to get started.
A Milwaukee business group, the Westtown Association, recently allowed Mayor Tom Barrett to make another pitch for the streetcar. Barrett told the group that federal money is there for most of the construction and early operating costs. For several years, the streetcar would just be in downtown and on the city's near east side. Barrett says, like with Governor Walker 5 years ago, rejecting dollars for high-speed rail in Wisconsin, if Milwaukee doesn't begin building a streetcar system, the money will go elsewhere.
It could go to the Cincinnati streetcar. It could go to the Salt Lake City streetcar. It could go to the light rail in St. Louis. And again, of course, it will then produce zero jobs in Milwaukee.
Barrett says building the Milwaukee streetcar would create about 700 construction jobs and a smaller number of transit jobs later. He also says the streetcar may eventually be extended to other parts of the city, but the downtown and east side have the greatest population density. This morning, a coalition of large businesses, including the Manpower Group, Johnson Controls, and the Marcus Corporation, released a letter supporting the project, adding to those already cheering the streetcar.
The beautiful Pabst Theater, one of the treasures of the universe.
That's recording artist Jim James at one of nearly 200 shows the Pabst hosts every year. Pabst Theater CEO Gary Witt says the streetcar would run a block or two from his venue and help businesses build a more engaged downtown community.
The greatest change agent in the city of Milwaukee is participation. It's no longer rich guys. It's no longer loudmouth radio hosts. It's participation. It's how people use the city that predicts the changes of the city in the future. And the streetcar is a beneficiary of that, or as a result of that, I should say.
Witt clarifies that he means conservative talk show hosts on commercial stations. Those hosts have teamed with a few conservative aldermen to try to block the streetcar. Alderman Bob Donovan says he doubts having a streetcar would make Milwaukee a better draw for tourists and younger people.
I have to laugh at that argument that somehow having a 8-mile-an-hour fixed-track streetcar is going to attract millennials, is going to attract young professionals to Milwaukee.
But Donovan and a conservative taxpayer group that helped Scott Walker get elected Milwaukee County Executive almost 15 years ago said this afternoon they're still short on collecting the thousands of petition signatures needed to force a binding referendum in April on the streetcar. So the conservatives are expected to try to delay by 3 weeks most of the streetcar-related items scheduled to be before the Common Council tomorrow. Chuck Quernbach, Wisconsin Public Radio in Milwaukee.
On a recent trip to the Philippines, Pope Francis made comments regarding family planning that are making headlines this week. While upholding the church's stance on artificial contraception, they're against it, the Pope suggested that Catholics may have a moral obligation to limit the number of children they have, and when it comes to reproduction, he says, in his words, they shouldn't behave like rabbits.
The National Catholic Reporter, a news organization that covers the Vatican, called the Pope's remarks on birth control unprecedented, and it's reopened a debate over the Church's stance on contraception and whether or not that could change in the future.
Joining us now to discuss the Pope's comments is Father Stephen Avella. He's a Catholic priest and a professor of history at Marquette University. Father Avella, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Glad to be with you.
So let's start with some context here. What prompted the Pope to address this issue on this trip to the Philippines?
Well, this happened in the context of one of these freewheeling press conferences that he has after he completes a major journey. And he speaks pretty colloquially and pretty straight from the shoulder, and he announces new things. And I think he values the opportunity to speak candidly and openly about what's in his mind and on his heart. And that's what you're getting here. If you look back at other press conferences that he's had, he's spoken in a way that we're not accustomed to hearing popes speak. Again, he's been a pastor, and so he's kind of been in the trenches, and he'll speak out of that experience.
So that's the style and the situation there. But what he said was the ban on artificial contraception is still in place. But Catholics don't have to have huge families. They can have smaller families to be responsible to. Is this anything all that new in Catholic history over the last couple of decades?
Actually, no. The encyclical he's referring to is Humanae Vitae, issued by Pope Paul. And in that, there is an endorsement of what we would call natural family planning, that Catholic couples have a responsibility or a right to space out the number of children that they have or to curtail the number of children that they have. The question would be the means by which they do it. The Pope in the 60s banned artificial contraception, and this, of course, then led to both natural family planning, which has a number of very strong proponents within the Catholic Church, becomes the acceptable form of Catholic birth control.
Well, while studying up on this, I came across this quote from Pope John Paul II in 1994. He said, unfortunately, Catholic thought is often misunderstood as if the Church supported an ideology of fertility at all costs, urging married couples to procreate indiscriminately. And he said, went on to say parents must have an extremely responsible attitude toward raising their children, including maybe limiting the numbers. So the language this time isn't maybe as fancy or as formal, but it's saying pretty much the same thing, isn't it?
Exactly. There is a continuity from Paul VI, John Paul II, even through Pope Benedict, although I'm not aware of him making a comment exactly like that. He may have. But there are many, many things in John Paul II that are quite amazing and quite similar to what this Pope is saying as well. The difference would be in the style. Francis is a man who says, I want to have the smell of the sheep. I want the Church to be engaged in the world. I can't emphasize enough, he's a pastor. He works in the trenches. I'm a university priest, but I work alongside diocesan priests, people who deal day by day with the real lives of Catholic people. And this question of how many children they should have, how they view child rearing and children, is something that a parish priest confronts each day and tries as best he can to give guidance and help, asking couples to remain open to the possibility of life, but also trying to understand the very real-life circumstances, the limits on finances, the health issues, all of that. The Pope is a pastor, and he's going to approach it not necessarily as a scholar or a supreme theologian, but as someone who's going to try and take people where they are and proclaim the gospel to them.
Now, on this issue, there's some tension within the Church. Polling in a number of countries suggests that Catholic laity, the rank and file, is more open to the concept of artificial contraception than the Church is willing to meet them at. So how is there any thought among the Church hierarchy that because of the opinions of many Catholics, they should revisit the issue?
Well, what you're saying is well known to any parish priest, that many couples do not really consider the teaching of the Catholic Church when it comes to how many children they're going to have, when they're going to have children. They practice as Catholics, they're participators in the Church, but this is just an area of their life where they've kind of taken back their own authority and said, no, thank you for your input, Father, or thank you for your input, Pope, but I have to live in my world. And so what you're saying is just obvious, that there is widespread dissent from the official teaching of the Catholic Church in this area. How then does the Catholic Church help people make sense of being open to life? Well, there's a lot of people who try to present a positive view of human sexuality, to encourage people to be generous and open their lives to new life and the like. There's been a lot of wonderful things that have been done in that area. But the dilemma that you pose is what happens when there is such resistance as this has been? Or again, it's not even a question. I've prepared couples for marriage, and they just breeze right past that question. I bring up the teaching of the Church. I bring it to their attention, but, oh, okay, that's fine. But again, you get the sense, and many priests would probably agree, that no, this is not something that you're ultimately going to decide, Father, Church, Pope.
Well, some outside observers seem to be reading the way Pope Francis was talking as an indication that maybe, like some other issues in the church, he might be open to revisiting this one. Do you see him opening that kind of door, or is that an overreading of what he had to say in this off-the-cuff talk with the media?
I think it's a bit of an overreading. I would say that there, when this was debated and discussed back in the 60s, it went through a long study process, beginning with Pope John the 23rd and then Paul the 6th. And the commission that he put together, Paul the 6th put together to study this, actually voted quite substantially in favor of changing the church's teaching and accommodating different forms of artificial contraception. Paul the 6th rejected that report and went his way, banning the use of artificial contraception. I'm not a bishop. I don't know where this is going to go. It would be worthwhile to take that report out again, that majority report, and to study it and to see what its arguments were and to try and understand what, if any, kind of wisdom was in them. That commission had theologians, it had married couples, and it had bishops. It had people, of substance and experience.
Father Avella will pick up that point after the news. Talking to Father Stephen Avella of Marquette University about the Pope's recent comments regarding family planning and birth control, we want to hear from you, too.
Pope Francis says no to contraception, apparently yes to family planning, responsible family planning. Do you agree, and what do you make of these comments? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Listening to Central Time, I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the Pope's recent comments regarding family planning and birth control. He says while the church still doesn't support the use of contraceptives, he wants to see responsible family planning. And when it comes to reproductive behavior, he says Catholics don't have to act, his words, like rabbits. What do you think about these comments? Do you support what the Pope is saying? Do you think it's time for the church to change its stance when it comes to artificial contraception? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Our guest is Father Stephen Avella. He's a Catholic priest and a professor of history at Marquette University. Father Avella, before we go to our callers, you're talking some about the history of the contraception ban in the Catholic Church. 1968, a big moment defining the official policy. But that's not when opposition to artificial contraception started, is it?
Oh, no, it goes back much farther, even back to the 30s. Pope Pius XI issued an encyclical called Casti Canubi, where he took on this issue largely in reaction to a liberalization within the Church of England and the worldwide Anglican Communion at that time, and reaffirmed Catholic opposition to artificial forms of contraception at that time. And then down, from the 30s forward, the ban on that has been fairly consistent and very, very rigidly enforced. It's a wonderful book called American Catholics and Contraception by a woman by the name of Leslie Tentler, who kind of charts, the evolution of this teaching. And then, with the invention of the pill and its marketing, it's being put out there as safe for use in the late 50s, early 60s, then the issue gets reengaged again. And this is why Pope John the 23rd removed it from deliberation at Vatican II and gave it to this commission. And then Paul the 6th continued that but expanded the commission, which, again, reported to him, and then from that came his decision in Humanae Vitae in July 1968.
Let's go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. Deborah is with us in Brown Deer. Deborah, hi.
Hi. I feel it's really a difficult decision, but to decide whether or not to ban contraception. But what would you rather have, contraception or abortion? And I feel if I had to pick the lesser of those, of the evils, it would be contraception. And I really think there's so many people on this planet as it is. I think Pope Francis is being extremely realistic. And I I know he thinks conscientiously about everything. I think he's making the right decision.
Deborah, thanks a lot for the call. A couple points there, Father Avella. First of all, she's seeing contraception as a lesser evil than abortion. Is that consistent in Catholic Church policy?
I would say that, you know, the official policy wouldn't want to choose between either of them. However, the position she expresses is what a lot of people feel. Again, you ask what we hear from the hustings, from the trenches. What your caller just expressed is what people in the kind of a common sense realism world here in America say, yeah, would you rather abort a baby or prevent conception altogether? And so, you know, the conclusion that she comes to is again, what I've heard many times from people. The other question about too many people on the planet is another issue, too, that Paul VI dealt with. And this also was kind of ties into, you know, one of the issues here in funding foreign aid and things, particularly out of the United States, that ties excessive birth rates or numerous birth rates to poverty. And I think the position of the church on that would be was rather than limit the number of children and, you know, decline the birth rate, why not share more equitably the riches of the world? Why not feed the world? Why not, you know, see to the development of the world from the abundance of some countries sharing with others? But again, I perfectly understand where the caller is coming from.
And Pope Francis has talked some elsewhere about environmental stewardship. Is that part of his view of a Catholic family's responsibility of not having a ton of kids? He's referring to a woman with an eighth kid on the way. Is that part of his thinking on that call for responsible family planning?
Well, I think he would use, again, view it in a kind of a common sense way. You can't keep having children at the risk of your health. Do you want eight orphans? He said to one woman who was on her, I think, her seven orphans on her seventh cesarean section. Do you want to, you know, leave these kids all alone? You've got to think realistically about this. His care for creation, his love for creation, tied into his name, Francis. You know, the who saw God in the world. I think it's very interesting that he's going to be issuing an encyclical, an official teaching of the church, or at least the teaching of very high order, on the question of the environment, on the question of climate change. At least these are what the early reports are that we hear. And yes, there is a concern for the well-being of the planet. There is a concern that we're able to live in this world and to share equitably the riches of the world. Tie this together with his emphasis on income inequality, which he's spoken about a lot more than he has about contraception, about some nations, some people having all the money and all the resources of the world and everybody else starving. I think you can link all these things together in some sort of coherent way.
Let's go back to our callers. We've got Abby on the line in Appleton. Abby, hi.
Hi there. Yeah, I just wanted to comment that I was born and raised Catholic. I, about 4 years ago, started working for a Catholic organization. And when I was told about NFP, I was like, what? I was completely astonished. I mean, I had never been taught it, never been told about it. You know, none of my family members practiced it. Now that I know, that is how we choose to live. But if the church wants people to practice, I believe it does need to be preached, because there are many of us that don't know.
Abby, thanks for the call. She says NFP, natural family planning, I believe, was not emphasized in her upbringing as a Catholic. Is that something that Pope Francis might support, talking about this more?
Well, it is emphasized a great deal now. Almost every diocese I know, including ours here in Milwaukee, has a very active NFP program and a family life program that actively reaches out. I know in wedding preparations that I've been part of, again, remember, I'm a university priest, not a parish priest, but there are materials that we hand out. The issue is raised in marital preparation and the like. I know I inquire as best I can and as diplomatically as I can about this question. So I think that what your caller mentioned might have been more a case maybe 10, 15 years ago. But I think in many dioceses that quotient of information has increased. Catholic radio, the Catholic television shows continually have programs on that sort of thing. So, yeah, I think the message has gotten out to a number of people, and some, like your caller, have said, yeah, this is good, this works for us. Others look at it and say, no, I don't think this works for us.
As we wrap up, Father Avella, you've written about Pope Francis since he first came into the job of being Pope. You're saying this issue, not really all that surprising, more maybe a change of style than substance. What has surprised you most about Pope Francis's tenure so far?
He is a man of courage. He's gotten extremely intense opposition within the church to these pastoral initiatives. This man is saying things and speaking to the world and inspiring people in a way that I haven't seen for a long time. John Paul II was a great man and really transformed the world. Benedict was like me, a college professor, a more retiring and shy and scholarly man who wrote beautifully. But Francis is one of the folks. Francis is someone who's down with the folks and understanding them and speaking a language of pastoral love and, above all, mercy. We want to be a place where people can feel like they can come and not be judged or condemned or sent to pasture. I just love this man. As a Catholic priest, I'm so inspired by him. I'm inspired by his courage. And as the Italians would say, avanti, Santo Padre, avanti, go forward, Holy Father. You're doing the right thing.
Father Avella, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Father Stephen Avella. He's a Catholic priest and a professor of history at Marquette University. Educators and scientists have been vocal lately with a message to students. The message, consider a STEM field for your career. As the case goes, the U.S. needs a strong field of upcoming science, technology, engineering, and math majors to stay competitive. And they say STEM fields pay well, too. In particular, girls are being encouraged to go into these STEM fields where there's a marked gender gap.
But our next guest says by urging kids to go into STEM fields, we run the risk of devaluing literature, art, and the humanities in general. Emily Eckhart joins us now. She's written for The Washington Post, Nature, and many other publications. Emily, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you.
Well, let's begin with your personal story. When you were a kid, you wanted to be a scientist. What happened?
Yes, I seriously considered a career in science. I've always loved science, and I still do. I think it's a very important intellectual pursuit, and scientists do lots of amazing work. However, at some point, I realized that science is great for studying our physical world, but it doesn't necessarily encompass the entirety of human experience. I was also interested in other experiences that I had, things about our culture, aesthetic feelings, interpersonal interactions. I found it really interesting to think about what is it like to be another person? What is it like to live well? What does it mean to have the feeling of beauty when you appreciate a work of art? And for those questions, I found music and literature to be the most interesting field, which I ended up majoring in college.
What was the turning point for you?
It took a couple years. I read a lot of science books when I was younger. In my article, I mentioned one in particular which really struck me, which was Lawrence Krauss's book, Atom. It's a really interesting book. It's about a single atom from the days of Big Bang to present. But the thing that really affected me about the book is realizing, are we just atoms? Is that all there is? And I think that was the moment when I became really interested in pondering other questions, like what does it mean to be a person and to live a good life in the short time that we have?
Now, it sounds like your choice to leave science behind came as a disappointment to some of your teachers.
Yes, my personal experience was that some of my teachers really had hoped that I would go into science, and some of them found it disappointing when I chose to major in music. One teacher said, I think maybe they were concerned about career prospects. One teacher said, Do you plan to work in a mall for your whole life? Obviously, my music teachers were excited about it, but I felt that the general attitude was one of that if you don't study a STEM field, then you are, in a sense, wasting your education.
There is a movement right now to urge kids to go into these STEM fields, in part because it seems as though maybe not enough kids are doing that, and part of it is to keep the United States competitive, part of it is to encourage girls. How would you describe what that movement is like right now to urge STEM?
I think there's a lot of emphasis on it in the headlines. There are multiple aspects to it. So one is the financial aspect, which is that in general, you can make more money if you major in a STEM field. There's another aspect, which is national competitiveness. There's a third aspect, which is women in science. People are really interested in increasing the numbers of women in science because they're not quite as many as men yet. And I think all of those are very important concerns. But at the same time, we do need to encourage students to study fields that might not necessarily be those.
Well, we do live in a time when people are questioning the worth of a college degree, and it seems like getting a job that pays well is part of the goal of that college degree because they can cost a lot of money. So from that angle, is it right to urge kids towards STEM fields that presumably are going to pay pretty well?
So I think financial prospects are definitely really important for college kids these days, and I've dealt with that myself. One thing that's really important, I think, to acknowledge is it's an oversimplification to say that all STEM majors lead to high-paying jobs right out of school and that all humanities majors lead to unemployment. Certain STEM fields, such as computer science and physics, yes, those are leading to high-paying jobs right now. However, other fields, such as biology, particularly if you decide to go get a PhD in biology, those fields are not highly paid. The other thing that's important is that majoring in humanities, it means that maybe you won't get a high-paying job right away out of school, but it does not limit your long-term prospects. Employers actually really value skills such as the ability to deal with subjectivity, the ability to make value judgments, critical analysis of speech and texts, the ability to write and communicate clearly. Some employers are saying that they're actually seeing a lack of these skills in the workforce. And long-term, humanities does not limit you. There are lots of successful people in business, law, all sorts of fields who did their undergraduate studies in humanities. Some of the more prominent examples are Ken Chenault, CEO of American Express. He actually studied history at Bowdoin College. Another one is Michael Eisner, former CEO of Disney, who studied English and theater at Denison University. In fact, a third of the Fortune 500 CEOs majored in humanities in undergraduate.
Wow, so there's a lot to be said, you're saying there, for going into humanities. And what do you think about the message it gives to kids? I mean, obviously it's important to have a well-rounded education and learning about science and technology, math, engineering, all that is part of that. But do you think that along the way that the humanities are getting a little bit shuffled off to the side?
Yes, I think they definitely are. I think there's a huge emphasis on things that we can measure in our culture. We're obsessed with data. We're obsessed with things that can be analyzed using algorithms and equations. In that strong emphasis on the quantitative, I think we do lose an appreciation that things like literature, music, history are really important for us as people and for our nation. I mean, nations are defined by their technological achievements, but also very much by their culture, by the novels and the music that they produce, and the ideas, the political ideas and the political history.
Well, what do you suggest that educators and others do to change that culture that's growing up around STEM right now and might be devaluing the humanities?
I think educators should definitely encourage students to follow their individual passion. If a kid is really interested in science and engineering, that's great. We need that. But if a kid seems to have a really strong interest in poetry, we need to recognize that that is just as important, that is just as valuable. We need that kid to grow up and be a poet and to encourage those strong interests that you see in your young students.
Do you think that would be a major sea change at this point, or is it something that can be done, that's doable?
Oh, I think it's definitely possible. There are lots of people who really value the humanities. And part of it, too, is that fields that don't necessarily draw in lots of visible money are always under pressure during times of economic hardship, which we've gone through recently. So in some ways, I think this is an ongoing problem. But I think there are lots of people who want to reaffirm that importance of music, of literature, of the arts in our national life.
What about looked at strictly from the angle of the gender gap in STEM fields? There's a big push to get girls involved in that into STEM fields, into STEM careers, to help balance that disparity. And that seems important not just for education, but for women in general. How do you balance that out?
I think it is a big problem that we're not seeing women lasting in science. It's interesting that we're seeing a lot of women majoring in science in college and even going into PhDs. So in some fields, for instance, biology, women actually account for about half of the PhDs, but the attrition rate is really high after the PhD program. This is a huge problem. We're losing a lot of talent this way. We definitely need to be making changes in the field that would encourage women to continue. However, there are also a lot of gender balance problems in humanities fields. So, for instance, there are hardly any female composers. There are hardly any female orchestra conductors. Very few female playwrights ever get their plays produced. Women are still struggling to achieve recognition as nonfiction writers. Until fairly recently, it was kind of unusual for women to even write fiction and be taken seriously. So, I think there are still a lot of barriers for women to be broken across the board, and we need to be encouraging our talented young women to break into all of these fields.
Right, so you don't want to look at one, rob Peter to pay Paul, so to speak. You want to emphasize it across the board for women.
Definitely.
And what would you say right now to encourage kids and educators to get them excited about the value of studying arts as a career?
I think teachers should perhaps encourage students to look at the many different career possibilities. So just because you major in something doesn't mean that you necessarily are going to have to be doing that one thing forever. It would be really great if people could have a broader definition of what is learning for, you know, to see it not as vocational training, but as a lifelong pursuit that can really enrich you for many years to come.
Emily, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
We've been speaking with Emily Eckhart. She's written for The Washington Post, Nature, Potomac Review, and many other publications. She studied music and English literature at Harvard University.